Hello, Internet. This is Chase Wassenaar, and welcome to Steam Cleaners, presented by the Rough Drafts Podcast Network. Every week, I and my lovely co-host play two games, two entirely different games than the ones we've played before, and we talk about them here on the episode you're listening to right now. And because you're here, you likely know that my lovely co-host, Walter C80s Fedchuk, is here and ready to talk gaming things. Walter, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing pretty well. You know, it is the day after Valentine's Day as we are recording. So had a lovely, lovely dinner at home with my beautiful partner. Made some carbonara, date in Italian, man. That's all I have to say. Dayton Italian, you're always going to be extremely well-fed. And we tried out a new little bit of a cocktail. I had my yearly review at work, and I was not happy with the raise I got. So I texted them, and I was like, hey, do you have any cocktails planned for tonight? And they said, I don't know. What about this? And I was like, that sounds perfect. So I got to open up a new bottle of bourbon to make a cocktail that's based off of Gold Rush, which is made with honey syrup. But instead of honey syrup, used ginger syrup. And it was fucking delicious. Bourbon, ginger syrup, lemon juice. It's a great cocktail. I'm sure it has a name somewhere on the internet.
I believe you, and I'm glad you enjoyed it. I'm not much of a whiskey guy, and I will admit I'm much more into honey than ginger, but I also basically just drink rum and cokes nowadays, maybe a tequila coke if I'm feeling spicy, so I am not here to judge anybody's drinks of choice, and I'm glad you were able to have a nice Valentine's Day. I'm also glad that you sent a link before we started this episode to a very interesting story coming out of the esports world. And since this is a gaming podcast, it feels like this is the time to talk about these things. Can you share with the lovely folks at home, Walter, what it is that you have stumbled across and why it's all very silly?
Yeah, so the crazy thing here is I had just like ran downstairs to grab some water in between our recording sessions and checked Twitter and saw somebody retweet quote tweet this article, and it's coming from Cecilia de Anastasio of Bloomberg News, that apparently Hector Rodriguez, the Optic founder, and Skump are suing Activision for having a monopoly over Call of Duty via the Call of Duty League, and an infringing upon the rights of anyone to run their own league, run their own tournaments, things like that. That was about 2.5 hours ago by how we're recording, and then about an hour later, Activision shared a comment basically saying that they demand that Mr. Rodriguez and Mr. Abner, Optic, Hector, and Skump demanded that Activision pay them tens of millions of dollars to avoid this meritless litigation, and when their demands were not met, they filed. And this is something fascinating that I don't know how much you and I like directly talked about, sort of the monopoly that developers hold over their games, and like the difference between League of Legends esports and like football is that the NFL doesn't own the rights to football. Right? They cannot tell the USFL, the XFL, college football, any of these things, you can't play football, right? The things they can do is they, used to tell casinos and the gambling industry, you are not allowed to use the Super Bowl because we have that trademarked, right? You are not allowed to use the logo from it. And the gambling industry was like, okay, we'll just call it the big game. And now that sports gambling has become so kind of ingrained into the NFL, the NBA, MLB, all of these things, and they have their partnerships, now they can utilize that, iconography and that wording. But some will still refer to it as the big game because historically that is what they refer to it as. In the instance of esports, Riot owns League of Legends, right? Activision owns Call of Duty. They own Overwatch. And this is something that has gone back and forth, especially with like Nintendo and Smash, of like, you can only run a tournament if you get a license from us. And like, here are all the requirements that you need to do to get a license from us. The prize pool can only be so large. In Smash's instance, they would refuse to give tournament organizers licenses if they ran Melee events. Like, all of these different things. And there has sort of been this like curiosity of like, is it a monopoly? right? Do they actually have a monopoly or not, because they own the IP, right? They own the intellectual property of the game itself. Does that allow them to force third parties into these licenses or not to holding tournaments? Or is there some kind of like free use that, you know, kind of situation? And to my knowledge, there have not been many lawsuits in this regard, and any kind of lawsuits that have begun to like explore or get into any kind of like discovery phase where you might start to have this discussion of is it a monopoly, sort of get, you know, brushed under the rug. There's a, you know, a settlement, or like something in the case of when the players went on strike for the Challenger League, you know, what, a year ago now, almost 8 months, 9 months ago, you know, they came to a solution so that there would be no lawsuits, there would be no discovery, and there would not be sort of this legal discussion about could I host a $1 million League of Legends tournament without permission from Riot? So I find this extremely fascinating, that it is Activision and Call of Duty, and that it is in fact, you know, Scump and Hector, of all people, very widely known in the Call of Duty community, filing this kind of a lawsuit.
Yeah, it is fascinating to me, because like now they're gonna just continue to compete in the Call of Duty League. Like, they're one major into the full competitive year. It's not like they're going to be going away. And it's just kind of odd that Optic Texas is going to be competing as if nothing's happening while this is all getting sorted behind the scenes. I had an interesting conversation with us on our Discord, the Rough Drafts Discord, for those of you who are interested. We haven't had like a link available for people to join in a while, but my take on this has evolved over time, because ultimately there is nothing stopping any individual from making a game like League of Legends that fulfills the same ultimate goals as a MOBA, in the same way that like the NFL and the Arena Football League are different, right? The sport is the genre when it comes to video games, more than it is the individual game title. That's much more equivalent to a specific style of play, which we have seen copyrighted and protected in various regions across various sports over time, right? You can't do things exactly the same way. Now, obviously, with stuff like FIFA, right, you're going to get different countries that all agree to a similar rule set. So it's not an exact one-to-one. But like Rivals of Aether is the answer to like, can I run a Smash tournament without Nintendo? You can make a game called Rivals of Aether that uses a lot of Smash mechanics, has all original characters, and for all intents and purposes can act like a Smash Bros. Style game. And that's perfectly legal and perfectly reasonable, right? And as long as other military shooters exist, it is going to be hard to argue that Call of Duty is putting a monopoly on a competitive first-person military shooter esports experience, right? Which is ultimately what you have to claim more than Call of Duty in specific. Because as long as those other options are available, it's not a monopoly. It's just the most popular version of it. So I don't think this gets anywhere, because as long as even stuff like Rainbow Six Siege exists, like, you didn't have to pay the entry fee, my dude. You could have just joined the other popular military shooter that people have found profitable. So good luck to them, I guess. But does that logic track to you? I'm curious if that's if you think that where will you come down on that, I suppose.
So the thing to me is that would be Activision's argument, right? They are going to say exactly what you said, right? There are other military shooters you could do. You could enter into agreements with Ubisoft or Rainbow Six. You could make your own game, things like that. Really, the interesting part of how this got brought up is actually somebody retweeting Harris Peskin, who is a partner at ESG Law, which is one of the like esports like law firms that cropped up, you know, when franchising did. And he, you know, has kind of holding back some of his like direct comments, as he says in a tweet, because ESG law represents many CDL teams. And I know they represent like a lot of players, too. But there's a thread kind of that he talks about some of the weeds of what's going to happen. And I don't think the argument is about whether they are creating a monopoly of military shooters. I think that Hector and Skump's argument, and I can't really read the full article because it wants me to log into Bloomberg, and I'm just not going to do that right now. But his kind of perception of this is more going to be an argument about whether the protections that are underneath, like, the Copyright Act, which are what are protecting the intellectual property Activision owns of Call of Duty, right? The logos, the, you know, if there's any special mechanics, like things like that, that are protected under copyright, if those are running into what antitrust law would be. And there, you know, he admits there's multiple things in here where, you know, the Supreme Court has upheld certain antitrust exemptions against baseball. If you've never read Lords of the Realm, which is basically the history and sort of creation of baseball, of the Baseball Players Association, the Baseball Union, highly, highly, highly recommend that book. It's really long. It's really dense. But Jacob Wolf suggested that on Twitter years ago, and I read it, and I think it's a fascinating book. But there are also exemptions that Congress has given, again, also kind of in baseball with baseball teams and the Curt Flood Act and like all these different things. But I think the core of this case is going to come down to, does copyright law, does the protection of Activision's Call of Duty intellectual property, does it run parallel with antitrust law? Is there a conflict there? Or, you know, which one reigns supreme? Does the copyright law reign? Sure, it's a monopoly of Call of Duty esports, but because there is IP involved, it's not that they are preventing other people from running Call of Duty esports leagues. They are just preventing them from utilizing their intellectual property, of which you can't separate it out of the game itself. So I do think it's incredibly fascinating, because it's one of those things of like, okay, well, if this is the case, right, you can't utilize the champion names in League of Legends if you're writing a gambling article, for example, or you couldn't use the models, right? That might be the argument, might be the model, the character model itself is intellectual property covered by copyright law. Therefore, sure, you can run a Call of Duty league. You just can't do any of the, you can't use any of the models, which then goes back to your point of, well, then you have to create a completely brand new game from scratch that you as the tournament organizer own the rights to. And it's fascinating. It is fascinating. And this is one of the first times that I can remember, and I can, you know, quickly kind of find on Google, that a team, right, or an organizer has basically said, fucking proven in a court of law. So I'm very curious to see where it goes from here. Although I do expect that there will probably be some, you know, behind the scenes agreement that'll happen, and in 6 months nobody will remember that this happened.
Yeah, I mean, the horizontal monopoly play is the only one I think these teams have, and I think there's a reason no one has wanted to take it into court, because historically copyright laws have been very much in favor of those who are holders of whatever mechanic, right? There's a reason we've gone so many years without the nemesis system in any game that we saw in the Lord of the Rings games for a little bit there, right? Like, we have accepted already in law that there are certain game mechanics, certain features that can be protected, even on a, you know, something that seems relatively generic and multi-genre faceted. I don't see this going well, but I think it's very funny that we're going to have to watch Optic Texas continue to compete while all this is going on. So for that reason alone, I'm excited that this is happening. And hey, I would love to see the courts try to navigate esports and professional video gaming, given how well they handle you know, topics like this accordingly, right? We know how good the courts are with tech stuff. So what could possibly go wrong? But, you know, Walter, we do have to move on because this is not an esports podcast. It's certainly not a law podcast. So our knowledge, I think, has officially been worn out. But it is a gaming podcast. And I think you have a very interesting game to talk about today.
Yeah, I definitely should have said I'm not a lawyer, but I'm not a lawyer and I don't ever pretend to be. And I don't think any lawyer on Twitter worth their salt would actually say, take my opinion as utter fact because I am a lawyer and know all the intricacies of this case or whatever. That being said, I did. I had a very, very interesting game to play this week. And the funny thing is Chase and I were doing our wrestling card for the Journey of Wrestling streams that we do on Thursday, every other Thursday. Go watch those streams. Go watch the VODs on Chase's YouTube channel. And I had been telling Chase that I had upgraded the hard drive that my operating system was on for my computer. It's something that I've been meaning to do for a while. Using money I got for Christmas, I bought a new full terabyte hard drive just because I had a super small hard drive that I no longer could update my graphics card without like uninstalling Discord and game clients and the Adobe client, like all these things. Like it was a pain. So I was like, I gotta upgrade this. And while I was doing that, I found out that trying to find the games on, you know, the non-C drive of your system, it varies from, a store platform to platform, right? Steam is relatively easy. You direct it to the file name and, the drive and the file folder that it's in it, and it uploads and goes, oh, yeah, all these games are downloaded. I happened to accidentally delete my entire Steam library when I upgraded my operating system. I don't know how I did that. So all the games that I had installed on Steam, gone. No longer installed on my computer. Did the same thing with the Origin client because I like to play Madden. Did that again, that process, you just direct the file, you start to download the game and then you direct it to the file location and everything. But Epic is an interesting beast. Epic is very interesting because there is no general setting to direct where you want your games to download, you know, in totality, right? There's no library function to it. Every time you download a game, you can change the file path to where you want that to download, which makes it very curious when you have like 10 or so games already downloaded on your computer via Epic. How do you get the store to recognize that those games are installed on your computer? Chase, what you have to do is you have to start downloading those games via file path. And then you have to pause it, cancel the download, delete the new folder, and replace it with the old folder that was already downloaded. So when this happened, I was slightly worried because I was in the middle of playing the game I wanted to talk about today. I was afraid I was going to lose my save file. And I told Chase this. I'm like, I'm afraid I'm going to lose my save file. I'm a little scared to check. I opened it up and I had my save file. So I was very happy I got to play some more of the game that I wanted. But I did not finish all the DLC, and it was my intention to finish all of the DLC. And Chase, the game that I played for today's podcast is called Escape Academy.
Yeah, I mean, so first of all, congratulations on navigating what sounds like a lot of nonsense to just get this installed in the first place. But yeah, I am very curious. Escape Academy seems like it's got the puzzle escape room style going on, but also has a co-op element to it. So I guess to start, what are the like kinds of puzzles that we run into? I know it can be tough to talk about puzzle games in specifics because every individual puzzle has its own eccentricities, but what kinds of, you know, generally puzzles are we talking about? And were you playing this alone or with a friend? Because I imagine it does change based on how you choose to approach it.
Well, Chase, I have no idea because I did not play co-op at all. I have no idea how the co-op works. So we can just say that right out in the open. I am sorry if you are curious about the co-op. I suggest maybe finding a YouTube video of it in action, something like that. I did not touch the co-op. It was something that I sort of, I meant to look at, but I just, I ran out of time and I never got the chance to. As for the puzzles themselves, have you ever done an escape room? Have you ever gone to one of those escape rooms and actually done one in person?
I have done an escape room in person. There's one in Steamboat where my parents live that was very kind to give us a couple extra minutes beyond what was how much time we should have had, because there was one puzzle that we figured out early and for whatever reason we couldn't get it to properly recognize what we had done, and so we moved on thinking we were wrong and needed to be steered back to no, something just kind of went awry here, but you were on the right track. And so I have been in the escape room, and I have watched the fantastic episode of Game Changer, which is the Dropout series of various game shows. And they have an escape room episode that may be per minute one of the funniest things I've ever seen in my life. So big fan of escape rooms here.
Fantastic. That's what these puzzles are. It is literally escape rooms. For those of you who have never done an escape room, like myself, what those usually are is it is a series of puzzles that will eventually, you know, unlock a door, right? If you're doing them in person, that's usually what happens. And sometimes there's multiple rooms that you travel through and so on and so forth. So like the types of puzzles you're looking for is like you have a lock, right? And it's a combination lock. What's the combination? Well, there will be clues littered throughout the room for you to figure out. I'll just kind of stay in like the beginning, the very, very beginning of the room, because there is a plot to this game, strangely enough, Chase. It starts and you're in this like derelict escape room in like what looks like a strip mall or something, right? And it's really shitty. And there is a combination lock, and like the clue might be like, don't run out of time, right? And there is a timer that is going. You have a certain amount of time to go through, but obviously like a timer is changing, right? The 20 minute timer that you have to complete the room is constantly changing. So that can't be your combination lock. So you would notice, oh, there's a clock in here. Well, the clock isn't moving. It's stuck to, you know, it's stuck at 12:30 or whatever, right? And then you look back at your lock and you're like, oh, there's four digits. Oh, it's the digits to unlock the lock is 12:30, 1, 2, 3, 0, and then it unlocks, and voila, you get another piece of the overall puzzle, right? Now, it may be that to open the door to get out of the room, there are three different keys you need to get for it, and that's what the first combination lock unlocks. It could be that that combination lock unlocks a piece to another puzzle that then leads you out of the room, like so on and so forth. So it is this... it is this maze of puzzles, and there's mazes, like there's a maze you can complete. Like there's all these puzzles that lead you towards the completion of a goal, which is escape the room, hack one of the faculty members, because the plot of this game is that you complete this like shitty escape room and are recruited by this this academy, right? Escape Academy, that is, think like Hogwarts, but for like escape artists, right? Like escape mm-hmm. room experts, spies type thing, right? And one of the teachers is like a mega frame, right? Like a giant computer, and it's like, I think you're cheating, and the only way that you can prove that you're not cheating is if you hack my mainframe, right? And like it is all of these different puzzles that you have to get to hack their mainframe and prove like I am as good as I say I am, like, and so on and so forth. So it's a lot of puzzles.
I like puzzles, as you know well. I've played a few different puzzle games on the podcast. Murder by Numbers, I think, is the one that most immediately comes to mind, since that was just Picross, but also some murder mysteries going around. And really, any sort of mystery game is a puzzle of its own kind, right? Where you're trying to put the individual pieces together to get to your kind of ultimate destination. But this seems like it's all from like a very cohesive identity, right? We have escape rooms. It's a tried and true formula for puzzle solving. And as you said, like each layer builds off the next, right? You're kind of going from clue to clue to clue to see how these pieces all fit together. And when an escape room is done really well, there is a story to it, right? Each room has its own theming that can be captivating. And you mentioned that there was a story, and I know you said you didn't want to get into all of the details therein, but do you think the story did a good job of both propelling you forward and helping every escape room feel unique beyond just the fact that they were different puzzles than the ones you'd just done?
Abso-fucking-lutely. I'm gonna be very blunt, right? I had this game in my Epic library. I don't know if I got it for free. I don't know how I got it, right? But I played through the main game and then bought both DLC packs. That was how much I enjoyed the game. And spoiler alert, I really fucking enjoyed this game. Chase, I highly recommend this game, and I know you will love this game. And like the cool idea, right? The interesting idea of it being this academy is that each of the different levels you're doing have these identities of, you know, classroom, right? This is you're working with a teacher, right? This is a class. This is something you're trying to complete, right? There's the artist that his entire thing is he wants you to tag this memorial wall that all the escape artists, you know, have their names on, right, when they graduate. And that's the goal of his class session, is you have to figure out how to get access to the wall and get access to the paint so that you can tag the wall. And oh, by the way, you have 30 minutes to complete this. And there's, you know, four different sections of this map that you then have to complete all of these things, right? There's this headmistress that when you were recruited, you go to her office and they're like, okay, cool. To test you a second time, you have to find where I'm hiding in my office before this gas, this amnesia gas, knocks you out and you forget about Escape Academy because we need to protect ourselves. Right? So all of the levels feel super unique because there is a character associated with it, right? And there aren't that many characters, right? So there is something that happens that like makes the characters come back again, but then there's like another unique aspect of the character. There is like a botany teacher where the difference between her two levels is like the first level is it's botany, right? She's trying to perfect tea. Right. She's trying to create the perfect cup of tea. And the other thing is, well, what else would a botanist chemist be good at? Oh, they're a bomb maker. So the second time you have to deal with them, you're dealing with bombs. Right. It's very fun. It really is pushing you forward. You have a little bit of a rival. There's not like a ton of dialogue. There's not a lot of like spoken word dialogue. There is not a lot of exposition that is given to you via conversation, but the dialogue that is given to you in conversation, which you don't have like dialogue trees or anything, right? It's just, you know, other characters talking, give you enough of a, you know, push forward to be like, oh, I understand what is going on, and I, you know, am pushing to be the best student at Escape Academy.
I love that as a concept, and I want you to know I've already wishlisted this game, so you have fully sold me on that concept. I love the idea, you know, escape rooms have so much variety to them. And if you can give me a reason that each one matters, and especially like the idea that you're like competing with other students to stand out in the academy, I love that concept. And I love the idea that it's co-op too, because I feel like, you know, obviously the fact that it is a video game means that it is built for single player to be possible in a way that I think real escape rooms can really struggle. But also, escape rooms are fun because you can bounce off of your friends and you're each able to take away different things. And sometimes you fuck each other over because you lead someone astray with a completely different idea than what is actually helpful in this context. That's that kind of chaotic energy is also very fun when it comes to, you know, what escape rooms are capable of. So all of this sounds super interesting. Are there any like criticisms that you have of this game? Is there anything that you think could have been executed better or perhaps you would like to see improved upon for future DLC? Because it seems like they're still making more DLC for this game.
Yeah, so here's the thing. I did not finish the DLC. I played through almost all of one. I got to the end, and I will say if I have one criticism of the DLC that I did play, the difficulty curve fucking spikes. Holy shit. By the end of that DLC, it is fucking hard. And you have hints, right? The game will absolutely give you hints, and it reduces like your score for it, but it's not like super penalizing. And this is the kind of game, like if you want to do it without any hints, like what'll end up happening is you'll just run out of time. You'll go back, you'll redo everything, and it won't be a challenge anymore because you'll already know 90% of how to do it, right? So you might as well just use the hints, because I don't know how much replayability this has unless you put quite a bit of time in between it or you have the memory span of a goldfish. There were a couple of puzzles that it could just be that I'm an idiot and I'm not as perceptive as I like to think that I am, that I did, like, I asked for a hint, and then when it showed me what it was, I was like, I'm a fucking idiot. How did I not see that? And in the main game itself, there was one puzzle that I just brute forced because I absolutely did not understand what it was asking me to do. And even then, when I got the hint, I thought, like, I'm doing this the right way. Why is it not telling me yes or no that I'm doing it correctly? So I just fucking brute forced it. Which, you know, you can brute force any kind of puzzle, right? There are only so many possible solutions. Sure, you may have 10 digits and 4 different spots on a combination lock. But eventually you can go through all the combinations, right? It'll fucking happen. It just takes a while. So I might say those are my two little criticisms, but overall I can't speak any higher of a game than one that I got for fucking free. I assume that I beat it and I immediately was like, yeah, I'll spend $20 on the DLC. I can't speak any higher of this game. I really, really enjoyed it. The only reason that I didn't beat the DLCs was that I ran out of time, right? Yesterday was as we're recording, yesterday was Valentine's Day. Like, I couldn't play anything yesterday. I was spending time with my partner, and that was, you know, 3-4 hours that I didn't have to play the game. I beat the main game and most of the one DLC in like 7 hours. And I would say it is 100% worth the, you know, I wish I paid $20 for this game. I wish I had paid money for it. I think that the developer really deserves it. And, you know, I'm looking at it on Wikipedia here. Ozzy Majai, I'm sorry, Kyle LeClaire from Hardcore Gamer said they hoped that it would be successful enough to warrant a sequel. Yeah, I fucking hope so too. I want more of this game, even if it's just more DLC.
Well, that all sounds fantastic. And yeah, I mean, it seems like they're still making more DLC. I would not be surprised if they, you know, puzzle games are very, they're interesting, right? Because as you said, there's not a lot of replayability, but there are always different iterations that you can do on the similar theme, right? There's a reason there are so many Ace Attorney games, right? Because you're never going to run out of mystery stories and different takes on similar types of crimes or genres or whatever, right? So I love seeing escape rooms gamified in this way. I think that all sounds like a blast. You are making it very difficult for me to not just hit that purchase button right now, though I have too many games I need to play before I get there. But you have presented a very strong candidate for my end of the year playing a game that you have played and enjoyed. So I'm going to keep that one in my back pocket and hopefully get my own chance to play it sooner rather than later. So I'm glad you loved it as much as you did.
Yeah, I I am so happy that I just like randomly read the description of it in my library. It was like, yeah, I'll give it a shot. Like I'll download it and see what happens. I'd have to go back and look through all the other games that I've played in the last, you know, few months to figure out the last game that I would place higher than that. Maybe like Penny Larceny off the top of my head, but even then, like, these are like fucking neck and neck. That being said, Chase, you have already told me the game that you're playing today, and that you have pushed other games down the list because you are just as excited to talk about this game as I was Escape Academy. So what's up with the Fabulous Fear Machine?
Oh man, what a lovely concept for a game. The Fabulous Fear Machine, if you are anyone who has even a vague interest in conspiracy theories or in the way that fear spreads within culture, and how that can be manipulated to various ends, do I have a game for you? The premise is very simple. You have this, like, the Zoltar, right, in the movie Big, you know, that kind of fortune teller. That can actually grant magical wishes, right? It plays off of that archetype, except this fortune teller allows you to make a wish, and it puts you in control of the Fabulous Fear Machine that allows you to use fear and influence in order to sway the populace to do what you want of them in order to fulfill the wish that you have made. It's very pulpy in terms of its fiction and flavor. Everything is done via these like old like Tales of the Crypt comic book style. So the illustrations are all super engaging if you like that like old comic book feel. The legends are such a variety of different things, you know, everything from, you know, the Loch Ness monster to your microwaves are actually being tapped into the radio by the government. You know, any of those, like, if you've heard of a conspiracy theory before, you know, ghosts to the Illuminati, this game allows you to prioritize it, take advantage of it, and use it to try to fill the populace with fear in a way that makes them more susceptible to your aims. But of course, with any wish like this, you know, there is always a catch. The monkey's paw allegory, if you will, remains very strong in this one. And each of our protagonists that you take over in each of the three story chapters of the game have their own goals that are very selfish driven, have very metaphoric ends that are a natural result of the actions that they have taken through making their wish come true. So it's almost like you should be careful what you wish for or something.
Well, yeah, absolutely. That's like the number one telling of any wish fulfillment story. So with that being said, what is like the goal, right? What is the thing that you are ultimately trying to accomplish? Because I am looking at this, at these screenshots that are kind of going by in Steam, and I am seeing particularly like maps of Europe, and I'm seeing like different colors spreading across the map. So, what are like the game mechanics, right? What are you trying to interact with, and what is the ultimate goal that you are trying to accomplish?
So at the start of every mission, you're given like multiple messages that you need to transmit to the populace, right? So let's say you're playing in the first campaign as Jen, who wants to become the head of a pharmaceutical company, right? You may have something like convince the public that they need this certain type of medication. Convince the public that natural remedies don't work and you need a like fancier medication to make that happen. or convince lawmakers that this medication does not need to be regulated because of how important it is, right? Each of these will have certain like fear quotients that you need to hit, and they may have some secondary condition, right? You may need to, you know, for the example of the health, you may need to play into a fear of death specifically, right? You know, if people are more afraid of dying, they're more susceptible to any transmission message that would convince them that your medicine could save them, in the example I'm pointing out, right? You assign your, you know, each area the message you plan to transmit. You plant a seed of fear from which everything kind of grows, and you try to spread that fear as much as you can. That starts by playing legends, these individual conspiracy theories that each boost a couple different types of fear. And you have the power, the form, the passions, and the occult, right? So each of these have their own different elements that you can play into and play off of in order to spread fear. And these legends level up over time. You have to use these agents that you have in the field to discover cities so that you can put legends in them, but also to farm the resources that are necessary to level up those legends that you have built, right? If you have an occult legend that you need to upgrade, for instance, you need to have someone farming enough vision tokens that can then be spent to level them up. And as they level up, you're given kind of this like detective board with a bunch of different words that are, you know, may or may not be associated with the particular legend that you picked. So let's just say the ancient beast, right? So you may have a word like, you know, prehistoric, or you may have like toxic, if it came from like a nuclear kind of reaction, right? And you have to figure out what words of the sea of words available are the correct one that applies to the particular legend that you're trying to upgrade. If you get it right, you get a bonus. If not, you get a smaller bonus. It continues to spread out the fear through that region. And you have to continue to upgrade and play various legends, spreading fear into each of the regions that are the focus of what you're doing. But it's not enough just to spread your own message. You also have to stop your rival from spreading their message, right? So in the example of Jen, our pharmaceutical expert, right? She might have to go up against another pharmaceutical company, a rival company that's trying to spread their own drugs in the area and trying to undercut whatever products that you're selling. Or you may have to go up against the Clean Europe Foundation, which is just an anti-drug organization that believes that you are selling addictive opiates to the masses without regulations, and that's a problem.
That would never happen.
This game certainly has a lot of social commentary that's very interesting to unpack. It's just kind of a fascinating mix of aspects here. But yeah, absolutely. Like, you have to like send your agents to infiltrate those rival organizations, dig up dirt that would diffuse their influence in those areas, and make sure that those rival ideas do not spread and potentially freeze you out of an area. All the while, you know, you need to be farming the resources that you need. You need to be discovering new towns and spreading these new legends and leveling up those legends over time. And a lot of this requires oleum, which is kind of this gasoline style energy source that is meant to power fear. You can only build it in a city in which the fear has already spread, but it gives you more of that resource over time, and it fuels the fear machine so that you can continue to get the resources you need to discover new cities or to play these legends that all have significantly expensive upfront costs. And so the strategy of the game comes from how you're using these agents, right? When do you farm for the resources you need to level versus when do you invest in the resources you need to shut down the agenda of your rival? Because those also require resources. And they may be different resources than the ones that are used to level up your legends. There isn't always crossover there. And you also need to be discovering new cities because you can't stop a rival action if you haven't established yourself there, and you can't play a legend in a place until you've established yourself there. And of course, you can only, there are multiple slots within those cities, so you have to then decide, when do I invest time into exploring these cities further so that I can have more options, more different things that I can spread in this individual area to get the fear as high as it needs to be for my message to be received. And oh, by the way, there are random events and random characters that will pop up over time that you need to address. You need to infiltrate and figure out how you can manipulate it to your own end, either by neutralizing something that would do damage to you in an area, or perhaps coming up with a way to twist it to your advantage if you have enough resources to do so. So, yeah. Does that sound like fun to you? Are you in so far?
I mean, yeah, absolutely. I am very invested. I like the comic look to it. I like the strategy. It reminds me quite a bit of like Plague Inc. And some of what you're saying, sort of the like resource management and movements. I guess I do know that is one thing that you have told me that you sort of struggle with sometimes is like heavy resource management games. So do you find that sometimes the resource management can kind of like get out of hand, become a little too complex, or do you think it's a pretty good balance of managing the variety of resources, or that it kind of funnels you towards, no, you're only going to focus on like one resource versus all resources?
Well, you know, I think it depends on the difficulty at the end of the day, right? At normal difficulty, I did not find it to be particularly difficult to balance all of these things, right? You don't need to have the same resource farmed in every city, right? You basically need to have one place that does each thing that you need. And if you are willing to invest in exploring to get multiple options within a city, which is a lot cheaper than discovering new cities, you can have multiple different resources that you can get at the same place, right? So you need one place for your politics. You need one place for, the passions, the heart that you can form, the vision, you know, but you also need one for pop culture or for destiny or for science. Or the occult, you know, these as long as you have one place where these resources can be found, you can always send an agent to go and take care of them. The puzzle becomes how you do so in the most efficient way possible, right? Because there is a time limit. If you take too long, the cat that hangs out near the fear machine gets bored and the mission will end. It can also punish you if you try to farm resources for too long, if it is possible for you to end the game and you choose not to because you want to do some story stuff. Eventually, the machine will tilt and it will end the level for you as a failure if you don't end it before that time. So it's not like you know into every level what you need to do, right? You know what your missions are. You know what legends you have. You know which areas need which type of legend and how you should be distributing these things. It is more just a matter of what is the most efficient and effective way to accomplish that task, because there's always something that you need to be doing. And with two agents, you can never be doing everything at once, but you can always be doing enough things to put out various fires, right? You may not be able to farm the resources you need to upgrade your legend the way you want, but you can have one person infiltrating the rival and another person getting the resources that are needed to shut down their agendas, which gives you a nice calm through which you can then take the time to farm up the resources you need and hopefully build up a stockpile so that you don't need to worry about it as much moving forward. you also have your different agents kind of specialize, right? Some of them are better at farming resources. Some of them are better at exploring. Some of them are better at infiltrating, right? So figuring out who is best suited for what task and making sure that you're maximizing their effectiveness is very helpful. And that can sound like a lot, but because it's only 8 resources, because there are only 4 types of legends, and because every element, no matter how you want to approach it, comes down to infiltrate your opponent to shut them down, build legends to build fear, and do so while getting as many resources as you can to keep the machine going, it's not overwhelming, and there's never a mystery as to what you should be doing. It's not a, how do I get the fear machine to do what I want it to do? It's, what is the most effective path to make the fear machine do the thing that I know it needs? And that's a very important difference and a much more interesting puzzle to me. I never feel with this game like I am lost or I don't know what I'm doing wrong. Anytime I failed, it was because I didn't prioritize things the way I needed to, or I wasn't paying attention to a resource that was time sensitive. But again, I was playing on normal difficulty, so that didn't typically come up unless I was like achievement hunting and adding an extra level of difficulty for myself.
Gotcha. So if you had sold me on this game, right? Like if this was already in my wish list and now is on the short list of games that I play at the end of the year, what's the but? What is the like frustration thing that you can sort of give me the heads up for here that would hopefully, you know, make the experience better? Or is there nothing that could be improved or that I need to be on the lookout for?
I mean, I don't think either of the elements I'm about to say are a problem per se, because ultimately, like, I didn't play this game to be deeply challenged. I could have played it at a higher difficulty level if I really wanted to push myself. I was playing for the story and the atmosphere and the experience, and that comes from, you know, challenging myself just enough that I needed to pay attention to everything around me, but not so much that, you know, it took away from any of those like narrative focused elements. But the two things I guess I would point to, sometimes the legends aren't particularly clear as to what adjectives you need to pick. It seems like something should work, but for whatever reason, it does not. And that can sometimes be a little bit frustrating. It's a very minor quibble, and like I said, you still get some bonus even if you get the word wrong. But there were definitely a few times where I picked an adjective and the game said that that didn't count, and I looked at the game kind of sideways like, are you sure? Because it kind of feels like this word should apply to the thing that just happened. But again, you know, again, you can do just fine without it. Even if you whiff on all three, it's very rare that that's enough to completely sink you. The only other thing I would say is that if you are playing on that easier difficulty, you can get to a point in which you are farming for the sake of farming, right? You've done everything you need to do to push the level forward, but the story beats that you want to experience haven't ended yet. So if you're particularly good at this style of game, you can be too efficient, for lack of a better phrase. I found multiple times that like I had to replay a mission because I fulfilled my goals too quickly. And so the tilt came up that would end the level because I was stalling before I'd even finished defeating my rival, who I had done such a good job of delaying that their like agendas that I was meant to thwart weren't hitting the board quickly enough for me to do so. But that is, again, like a thing you can change for yourself, right? You could just increase the difficulty if you wanted to. And ultimately, like, I was stalling because I wanted to see every legend play out, because every time you level it up, you get another layer to the story, right? You get another beat from this kind of pulpy comic that is presented to you. And every time you transmit a message, you learn a little bit more about the character that you're currently playing as and their narrative and how that has impacted them and the world around them, right? I'm focusing on Jen because she's the first one, and I don't want to spoil the entirety of a game that is very narrative driven. But it, you know, it turns out, right, that if you push, an addictive drug onto people without acknowledging the consequences that that can have, that might have a negative side effect that at some point comes to bite you if you haven't taken care of the things that would protect you from the inevitable backlash, right? It feels cohesive in that way. It especially feels cohesive because all of these stories are connected in one way or another. Jen pushes this drug, and then you get to the second person, Jimmy, and it turns out that his hands are shaking because he has an addiction problem to that very drug. So the consequences make it feel like there is a lived-in world, and you know, you wonder how much your actions with the fear machine in one place led to the inevitable issues that drew someone else to use the fear machine elsewhere. And that's fascinating and rewarding. And I know I just took your question about the butt and turned it into multiple positive things that I love about this game. And that's because the butts really don't matter. It really, they're minor quibbles that mostly had to do with me enjoying the game enough that I learned how to play it so efficiently that I got mad when the game told me I was wrong. And every now and then I had to slow my effectiveness so that I wouldn't have the game end before I got to see the story stuff I wanted to see that I was very deeply invested in.
That is also very you, that you are a bastion for optimization and figuring out the best, most efficient way to play a game. That being said, you mentioned how the plots kind of like feed into each other. Are there enough choices within like the first story that they could affect the second story in a different way? Is there kind of like branching storytelling here? Or is it... Everything is, you know, diverted. Everything may be separate, but then it eventually diverts or eventually comes to the exact same point. And then that is the point that affects the next story. And then it all kind of branches out, but then comes back to the exact same point that then affects the next story.
It is a linear story experience.
Okay.
There are no decisions to be made. You have your missions that you are completing and the messages that need to spread, and those are the same every time you play an individual mission, right? There's one thing that you're trying to accomplish, and that thing is built on your individual goals for that character that you've built, right? Jen in this case doesn't just want to be like a pharmaceutical success story. She wants all of the world's eyes to be on her. She wants to be seen and regarded as popular, special, whatever adjective you want to push, right? That's what matters to her. And so everything that she does, you will unveil step by step these comic book pages that reveal her story and lead to the inevitable monkey's paw-esque conclusion that all has a nice dramatic, dramatically ironic twist, right? But what it is it's a world. So there are recurring elements and recurring characters that come through, right? You may have a politician, for instance, that uses his corruption to help you out or maybe manipulate you in one campaign. And then in the next campaign, that politician that you used your fear machine to help is now in a more prominent place and has more to offer the new character that you've played, right? It wasn't a choice that you made. It's just more that this is a living world and these stories build on each other. It's yes anding in a way that makes it feel cohesive rather than it being something that you have direct control over. The fear machine is going to end one way. And when it ends, the person who used it will be added to the Fear Machine and their story forever a part of what it builds. And you just get to see that unfold for yourself.
I mean, it's on the wish list, so I'm going to assume that you're going to say that you highly recommend this game and everyone should go out and play it.
I haven't shut up about this game. This is one of those where I played it and I immediately fell in love with it. The art style, the theming, you know, as someone who loved like the Pandemic Flash game a while back, right? Seeing this outbreak sim is, I think, how they describe the genre, right?
Yeah.
Like your need to spread your, in this case, fear from place to place and figuring out the most effective way to do it. And every campaign adds new challenges, new ways of interacting with it, new puzzles that you have to kind of work around and take into consideration when you are building out your strategy. All of that is engaging and fun. But it is the storytelling and world building, right? The characters that you embody, but also just the lore that it builds, these different legends and how they reveal themselves over time. If you have any affection for that kind of pulp comic genre, any affection for, you know, conspiracy theories and what makes them work and how they're manipulated and whatnot, there are a lot of interesting thematic story elements for you to enjoy and engage with. And my only, like at the end of the day, the only thing that bums me out with this game, it's not any of the small quibbles I mentioned earlier. It's that because it is narratively driven completely, I finished the third chapter and I went back and I 100%ed the game through every achievement it had to offer, which is not a thing I do even for games I have highly recommended on here. I 100% completed this game because I was having so much fun with it. And now it's done, because there is no free play. There's no way to continue to engage with it and experience anything new. I have seen everything this game has to offer, and I want more, damn it. I want more stories. I want some way to build a free-form mode where you have different types of puzzles and different combinations of legends that like people could make in a Steam workshop to continue to challenge yourself, right? And if the biggest thing that is left is, man, I wish there was more of this, you've done something right.
It certainly sounds like they did something right. That's really cool, and I'm glad you got to enjoy the game so much. I was very excited to actually hear what this game was about after you kind of hinted at it to me a few times.
Yeah. And I, you know, I will say, I'm glad, that you're hyped for it. I hope that the people at home are excited about both games we talked about, because these were two, highly praised games, that, hopefully y'all enjoy as much as we did. If you do play these games or have played them in the past, we'd love to hear from you across our social channels. Walter, where can the nice people at home find you?
Yeah, as always, you guys can find me at C80s_LOL on Twitter, at C80s.bsky.social. You can follow the podcast at Rough Drafts Pod on Twitter and at Rough Drafts Podcast. .bsky.social. And as always, you can also listen to it on your favorite podcast platform of choice, either on the individual show feeds, that is Steam Cleaners for the Games, Final Cut for the Movies, or on the combined Rough Drafts podcast feed.
Absolutely. You can find me, Chase Wassenaar, on both Blue Sky and Twitter. Always love hearing from y'all. And I hope if you enjoy this kind of video game talk and you want to see Walter and I play some games in action, you should definitely check out our Rough Drafts Competes League, which is our journey of wrestling competition, really putting our wrestling narrative storytelling to the test. It's been a real fun time. Twitch.tv/RedShirtKing. Every other Thursday, we do our pay-per-views there. And I do have a playlist on YouTube for all of the weeklies. I really just need to put the playlist together and make it more publicly available. Right now, they're just kind of sitting on a YouTube channel that I haven't used very often, and have a lot of very unimpressive videos from like back when I was in college and just starting as a content creator. So I have to figure out exactly how I want to market that. But for now, definitely go check those out. And definitely come back in 2 weeks where Walter and I will talk about two completely different games that hopefully we'll enjoy as much as we enjoyed these. So until next time, goodbye, Internet.